couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, Spirit Untamed, Lisey's Story, and Sweet Tooth. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring supplementals from Borat's subsequent movie film. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is Ellie Kemper. She's best known for being on The Office as Erin and, of course, being the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt in the title role. There was a little bit of a hubbub that somebody had released a story or a photo that she had been the queen of, basically, it's this debutante ball that takes place in St. Louis, Missouri, which is where she's from. And she was like the queen of the ball in 1999. Now, if you go back and look at the history of the organization, it's got some controversy surrounding it. One of the things is people have said that it's exclusive, that it was not a racially inclusive club. And more importantly, people started labeling her as a KKK queen. And as best I can understand from the stories I've read, is it's not that the organization's part of the Ku Klux Klan, but apparently, if you go back a couple hundred years, some of the ceremonial dress they use, one of them is a white hood and robes. But what's interesting about that is they got rid of that outfit long before the KKK actually became a well-known thing. So there doesn't actually seem to be a thread line between that. It's just, if you look at the history of the ball, they are wearing something that is similar to KKK outfits, even though the KKK hadn't popularized it, so to speak. It's sort of like if you were to look at some examples of symbols in the Hindu religion, there's swastikas in there. Well, those things existed long before the Nazis used the swastika. People are out there trying to besmirch Ellie Kemper, and as best I can tell, she comes from a very wealthy family in St. Louis, and this is a debutante ball that had been going on for centuries, and she was involved in it when she was 19. It's the kind of a ball that is covered by local news, and yeah, it had certain controversies and that sort of thing over the years, but she was 19. It's not like she's running around in KKK robes now or something like that. This is something she did as basically a beauty contest in her hometown when she was a teenager. This is not railing against cancel culture, because let's face it, there are some people that needed to be canceled. You know, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, people like that. You know, when you're a rapist or a murderer, yeah, you probably should be canceled. But what this reminds me of is when the Me Too movement started to kick off, there were people who got caught in the crossfire who really were either misunderstood or somebody just overreacted. There was a whole incident with Aziz Ansari that I talked about on this show. There have been a couple stories that have popped around about Gal Gadot and some of what she did and how she acted when she was younger and a model. And look, you know, I mean, people can make mistakes and people can change over the years. And just because you do something stupid or silly or mildly insensitive when you're younger shouldn't haunt you for life. Somebody going to a beauty contest when they're 19, and even if it's somewhat controversial of an organization, that still doesn't mean that this woman needs to be removed from entertainment throughout the board. The next piece of news I wanted to hit really quickly is the box office, which was very good over the last weekend, over Memorial Day weekend. I predicted this. I said, when this happens, you're going to start seeing all these stories of the box office is back. Theaters are back. It's unstoppable. We're where we were before. First of all, these are not pre-pandemic numbers. Now, granted, the box office went over $100 million for the first time in over a year. And that's good. And the numbers were good. I mean, The Quiet Place did close to $60 million over the four-day weekend, which is about on par with the first Quiet Place did. But even then, that's still suffering from COVID fatigue. It's still weighting it down, because generally, when you have a movie that is a surprise hit and it makes $50 or $60 million in the theaters on its opening weekend. And then you do the sequel and it's highly anticipated. You expect it to be more, but it was right on par, which is great for today's numbers. But you got to realize there is still some sluggish box office down there. The thing that happened with these two movies, both A Quiet Place Part Two and Cruella, is these were objectively good movies. They also had a good buzz. They were liked by audiences and critics alike. These were not controversial. They didn't have mixed reviews. It was kind of a perfect storm for these movies. So don't expect the box office to light up on fire every single weekend as we move forward. But the other thing that has kind of flown below the radar is how well Cruella did. Cruella made $25 million or so over the long weekend. And I keep seeing reports where they're saying, oh, it left the box office on the table because they didn't get it all in that first run. But they didn't. I found a number that was just under 700,000 households decided to pay that extra $30 to get Cruella over the course of that weekend. That translates to a little more than $20 million. And that's 100% Disney's money. So that's really closer to a box office of like $30 million. Which means that it's equivalent to an opening weekend approaching what A Quiet Place Part Two did. And that's great numbers for a movie like Cruella. And the real great decider is going to be what happens with Black Widow in about a month, when people decide whether or not they're going to want to stay at home and watch it and pay $30, or watch it in the theaters, or both. And I think it's going to be a big hybrid release. If they just get 5 million households, which is not unattainable for a Marvel film, that's like $150 million that Disney would be able to hold, which is closer to $200 million at the box office. If it does that in its full run in terms of the Disney Plus subscription high price premium, that could be a game changer. So I've said for a long time, this is not over yet. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is Escape Room Tournament of Champions, which is in theaters July 16th.
We were lucky to get out of those escape rooms alive.
I need to know that the criminals who killed the four people in front of me are held accountable.
They're hiding in plain sight in the middle of Manhattan.
We need to stop them.
I'm in.
You gotta be kidding me.
Hold on!
Welcome to Minos Escape Rooms.
No, no, no.
It's happening again.
You guys have played the game before?
So what is this? Like a tournament of champions?
Here's a great one to not get overly excited about box office. This was originally supposed to come out in January, but of course, the pandemic. So it's gotten moved to summer, and it's gotten moved to a kind of a tentpole release date, because that's when everyone's finally going into the theaters full blown. So this movie's not going to play the same in July as it would in January, is like sort of like that first week of release. And while it looks like it's just going to be more of the same, I mean, I saw the first Escape Room. It was fine for what it was, but it doesn't look like this is going to be very much different. You got to temper your expectations for box office. The next one I want to hit is Old, which is in theaters on July 23rd.
What happened to her?
Body has decomposed.
How quickly can that happen?
7 years.
But she just died.
Wait, where are the kids?
Trent!
Kara!
Come here!
Hey, have you seen my children?
Mom? I'm right here.
Dad, why are you looking at me like that?
What's happening to us?
My daughter just turned 6 2 weeks ago.
Mom!
Whatever is happening to us is happening very fast.
You have wrinkles.
Again, I'm a big fan of M. Night Shyamalan, and I remember when the first trailer of this dropped at Super Bowl last year. Now, I don't think you're learning a whole lot more out of it, but I don't want to learn any more of this. I want to just go see this movie. I like M. Night Shyamalan. I like his Twilight Zone level of thrillers that he makes. And I know they're cheesy and they're corny and they're gimmicky, but that's okay. I enjoy him. So I'm going to have to say I'm looking forward to this one. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Spirit Untamed and Lisey's story.
Unbreakable. They alive, damn it. It's a miracle.
Thank you.
Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Spirit Untamed. A girl travels out west with her family and befriends a wild stallion sought by horse rustlers.
Welcome to Miradero.
And Cora, did you ever see my mom perform?
Oh, yes.
She was a legend.
Fortuna?
Hola.
You look just like your mother.
You must be Lucky Prescott. I like your dress. Oh, and your shoes. I didn't know shoes could be cute.
Whoa, horses can do that? Is that barn okay?
This horse got a lot of spirit.
You do have a lot of spirit.
I was unaware of the Spirit franchise. I was aware of the first installment, which was like 20 years ago, and DreamWorks had done this ink and paint release that was called Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron. And it was a story of a horse, and it followed the horse around. Now, the horse at one point befriends a young Native American who's caught in this post-Civil War camp, and this general tries to tame him, but he escapes. And it's the story of this horse and his adventures. Matt Damon provide narration as the horse, even though the horse didn't like talk to people. And actually, Spirit Stallion of the Cimarron was quite a good movie. I enjoyed it, and I went back and watched it recently. But that's a good movie. It was nominated for an Academy Award. It didn't win, but it was nominated. And then, I don't know, about 10 years ago, Netflix started a series called Spirit Riding Free, which was CGI, and it was kind of rudimentary CGI, but it was about this girl who goes out west, and she befriends this horse, and she has friends in this small town, and the series is the story of these girls and their adventures with their horses. It's very much aimed at, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory sense, but it's very much aimed at horse girls. You know, there's a lot of girls out there that love horses. I've heard stories. I don't know if this is true. I've not verified it. But like when they do movies like Lord of the Rings, when they need people who can ride horses, they a lot of times have to enlist women because there are many, many more girls out there that work with horses than guys. And also they tend to be smaller and it makes it easier for the horse to, horses get annoyed when somebody my size gets on top of them. So when a 100-pound girl gets on them, they're like, no, this is cool. I can deal with it. But this is who that series is made for. And this show ran for like, or continues to run for like 8 years. There's something like 8 seasons and a whole bunch of specials on Netflix. I didn't even know it existed. But then they made this movie, Spirit Untamed, which is a CGI, much better animation than the TV series. But it's essentially a version of the series only for the big screen. They sort of retell it from the beginning. So it's aimed for a younger crowd. It's aimed for, you know, girls who like horses. Of which there are a lot. And with that said, I mean, the movie works. I mean, it's somewhat of a simplified story and, you know, it's not heavily complex in relationships. So it's aiming for grade school and maybe even younger grade school audience age. And like I said, it's better animation than the series itself. In that sense, it's not my cup of tea, but, you know, it works. And I've seen enough of these Netflix shows for kids that I feel they at least massage the story a little bit more to make it more cinematic. And it has some fun. It has some excitement. It has, you know, sort of the girl power stuff. And, you know, the horse Spirit is prominently featured in it. And even though he's never quite captured, he's always allowed to roam free. So I'm going to say, you know, Spirit Untamed for the right audience and who it's aimed for. Kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Lisi's story. Stephen King adapts his novel for limited series on Apple TV Plus about a woman who is targeted by a deranged stalker who is an overzealous fan of her dead husband, a famous writer.
I'm on a bull hunt.
What's a bull hunt?
Like a scavenger hunt Scott and his brother made up when they were kids.
Mrs. Landon,
I just thought I'd give it one more try in person.
Scott's unpublished works need to be collected, examined.
You are never going to see his papers.
She won't let them go.
I'll get those papers for you.
One of the things Stephen King has done since very early in his career he kind of breaks certain rules, like chronically, that you shouldn't do as a writer, for example, making a story about writers. I mean, I know there's that whole write what you know, but he draws from that a lot. And there's a lot of his stories that are about writers. The Shining is about a writer. The Tommyknockers is about a writer. This one is about a writer. He does tend to write what he knows a little bit too much at times. And in this one, it draws even closer to home because it deals with a writer with fans that, well, let's say, aren't quite stable. And Stephen King has those fans. Absolutely, he has those fans. And he's run into them before. And so I think part of this is him venting his spleen about those people and that type of celebrity status that he has, for better or for worse. Now, the series itself is impeccably acted. It has a great cast. It has Julianne Moore playing Lisey. You've got Clive Owen playing her husband, who you see mostly in flashbacks, but he's in there quite a bit. You got Jennifer Jason Leigh and Joan Allen also playing her sisters. And you got Dane DeHaan playing this deranged stalker. And if you're familiar with Stephen King's work, you see a lot of familiar tricks that he puts out there, a lot of familiar elements to his stories. It's got a backstory with the writer's character and his childhood, which was abusive and traumatic, and dealing with a brother that had issues. There's a lot of darkness there. And here's the thing. Stephen King has always been very, very dark. But what's weird about Stephen King, and I don't quite know how to put this in words, but I'm going to try. There's a familiarity to his writing. There's a familiarity to his characters. There's a friendliness to him in a strange way. Even as dark as the stories get and as dark as the subject matter gets and as just depressing and nihilistic at times, you still could see yourself going and getting a beer with one of the characters. You seem like you know them, and there's a friendliness to them. I wouldn't say a warm and fuzziness, but there's a familiarity to it. And there's a comfort that you have because his characters are so well made in his books. I've not read the book that this is based on, but I don't know whether it's Stephen King in adapting it in writing the teleplays for this or if it's the director. There doesn't seem to be any of that. He keeps all the stuff that makes it very Stephen King-ish. You know, he has these interesting characters, this fantastical element to it, this almost spiritual side to it. He has all that stuff, but there's no warmth to it. There's no familiarity to it. There's no friendliness of characters. I don't feel like I would want to spend any time with any of the characters in this. They all seem very depressing and dour and morose. And yeah, it's a Stephen King story, but there's nothing fun about it. I mean, the people are just somewhat abrasive, and it's so dark and so heavy, and it plods along that it just becomes a dirge. And as interesting as some of the things that go on in this series are, it's not a fun time. I just didn't find myself enjoying spending time in that universe. And part of it is it drags. There's entire scenes where people are whispering dialogue to each other that is impossible to hear. It almost takes itself too seriously. There's a whimsy that Stephen King usually has that is absent in total. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to talk a little bit about The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, and we're going to start things out with an interview. I've had a chance to talk to Paul Wilson, who is the brother, the older brother of Patrick Wilson. He's a friend of the show. We go back for several years, and he plays the father of the original kid that is possessed in the movie where it starts out. The character's name's Carl Gliesel. And it's not a huge role, but it's certainly pretty significant in the first part of the film. And I wanted to play some of our interview here. You can hear the whole thing if you go to fatguysatthemovies.com. There'll be a longer extended version of this interview, but this is the radio version, so it's a little bit quicker. And then we'll come back around after it, and I'll do my review.
I don't know about you, Kevin, but I'm the guy that kind of gets really spooked to the bone on facts. And so here's a story that's based on fact. And we have this trial of Arne Johnson, the very first time ever in American legal history where an accused murderer pleads not guilty by reason of demonic possession. Now, I play Carl Glatzel in the movie. Basically, I'm the dad of the family that, you know, has to call Ed and Lorraine and go, my son's acting kind of weird. And then they show up and then they're like, something's happening, right? That's the beginning of The Conjuring 3, Devil Made Me Do It. Patrick and I were talking earlier last week about how this really is kind of a love story, which kind of struck me like, boy, you don't see that smack up of love and horror together. But these two people loved each other, and you'll see love endures. So in a lot of ways, it's about love. And I think that's where this story really soars to.
I would say that's a through line in the Conjuring movies, especially with the characters of Ed and Lorraine.
I think the two of them, aside from having a great, you know, on-screen chemistry, I mean, they're friends. And the two of them, aside from being exquisite actors, really kind of, you know, got it. And I think as an actor, the tough part is when you're playing real people, the hard part is to bring humanity to it, because these people were loved, right? These people were someone's mom, someone's grandma, someone's granddad, someone's brother, someone's child. And there is a sense of humanity that I think Patrick and Vera do incredibly honestly. Most horror movies, they start with the antagonist. So to have this one really kind of rally around the couple that loves each other unconditionally, that's kind of inspiring, even through all the turpitude and all the scary. And by the way, there's a lot of scary.
You hear all these stories about movies like The Exorcist, where there's always some weird stuff going on. Did you experience any strangeness, any creepy moments on the set that would bring any sort of realism to the development of the film?
At the crux of this movie is the argument. Your Honor, you can't argue the existence of God in the courtroom if you can't acknowledge the existence of the devil.
You shot this 2 years ago. This was originally supposed to come out last summer, right? In 2020.
No, September 2019. So we shot it, you know, June, July of 2019. So we were hoping and targeting for a September, you know, early September date of 2019. Mm-hmm. Then all this happened. And, you know, we had a lot of, let's say, really good feedback from the team. And, you know, some audiences gave us some great ideas. When you're in a, you know, studio flick like this, you have a lot of great people that are involved in kind of making sure that this story will, you know, resonate, not just initially, but kind of down the line. I think you will see a better movie than we actually could have had in 2019 because we had some great feedback.
Because it's Warner Brothers, it's going in theaters and on HBO Max. What are your thoughts on that? Is it better for the theater, better for at home with the lights off? What do you think?
Candidly, you don't want to see this movie alone. It's a date movie. It's a fun movie. Go see it on the big canvas. Go see it in the theater, because you'll see an homage to a lot of movies. If you're a horror nut like, you know, us, you'll see an homage to a lot of classic horror movies. And that's kind of fun to see on a 60-foot screen. Certainly enjoy it later on HBO Max. What I think I love about what Warner has done with this and New Line has done with this, I really love that it's like available to everyone. I think it's going to help everyone kind of get it that they're not done. And by the way, they're just starting. Ed and Lorraine Warren had over 1,000 cases. This is the third story.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's now talk about the movie itself and get a review here. And that is The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. The latest installment in The Conjuring franchise sees Ed and Lorraine Warren doing battle with the demon possessing a man accused of murder.
Residents of Brookfield were shocked this afternoon by the broad daylight murder of Bruno Sauls.
The court accepts the existence of God every time a witness swears to tell the truth. I think it's about time they accept the existence of the devil.
Whatever is going on, whatever happened that day, that was not Arnie.
I have been an unabashed fan of the Conjuring movies. I've liked the Annabelle movies as well. I mean, the whole Conjuring universe, some are better than others. I thought The Nun and The Curse of Yorna are a little bit rough. But I've certainly enjoyed the Conjuring movies. I've enjoyed the Annabelle movies, too. And I like how they've kind of just built these characters into these unlikely heroes. And I mean, there's just like 10 movies in the series. And in particular, I have a lot of respect for James Wan, who kicked off this series. He did, within a couple of years, Insidious, and then he did The Conjuring. And one of the things he did, a lot of people forget, historically, when this came out, it came out in the middle of the big push for found footage movies and the big push for CGI and that kind of effect. And a couple things that James Wan did when he did the original Insidious and then The Conjuring a year or so later is he went back to good old-fashioned haunted house horror. Lights and shadow, where you had practical effects, where you had things in the background and subliminal issues. And he didn't rely on shaky cam and found footage and that as a gimmick. In fact, he went back to these long, slow, steady shots. There's some effects that go on, sure, but there's a lot of stuff that takes place in camera. And I really appreciated that. And I like the fact that James Wan grabbed horror, like mainstream horror, by the throat and brought it back to its roots. And so I will always appreciate what he did in sort of recentering horror. Now, Wan doesn't direct this one, he just produces it, but the idea is still there. And the other thing it does, and what's funny is Paul pointed this out in the interview. He's like, this is really a love story. It's the story of Ed and Lorraine fighting this demon and the problems that they're facing and the things that they go through and how they try to stop it and how they try to win. And really, if you go back and look at the other Conjuring movies, in particular, the second one, there is a lot of that bonding between the two characters that really is the heart and soul of the movie. In the other spinoff movies, getting families to kind of come together. And that goes back to the Amityville Horror, which is, of course, a famous case that the Warrens were involved in. That goes back to The Exorcist. Later on, you have other movies like Poltergeist that deals with family challenges. And I found this one to work out really well. And I thought it was an interesting difference from the other Conjuring movies, because even though the Warrens are coming in to help somebody, it's much more about them. They're the primary characters. They're not just showing up in the second act to help things out. They're there from the beginning. It's not as good as the first two, and that's okay. I mean, the first two, especially the first one, was this spectacular, wonderful surprise, and I don't think you're ever going to capture the freshness of that again until you don't have it in the theaters. But they do a lot of practical and in-camera effects, and yeah, they got some CGI that helps things along. And the story's interesting enough because the story's not just about a ghost and some scared waif who's running away from it. It's about, you know, seasoned demon hunters who are trying to fix things. And it turns into a bit of a detective story as well. And that's kind of what I appreciated about it. It's not just a paint-by-numbers movie, but they really make a point to at least tell something different than what they've done in the past. So I'm going to have to say that it's still worth checking out. The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Sweet Tooth and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the supplementals of Borat's subsequent movie film. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with a TV review. Sweet Tooth. Based on the DC Comics, this series follows an animal hybrid child trying to survive in an apocalypse brought about by a mysterious virus.
Where's Colorado?
What's in Colorado?
I heard there's a safe place for kids like me.
If you go out there alone, they'll have your head by morning.
I'm not alone. I got you.
Guys like me aren't good for kids like you.
How do you know? Most people hate kids like me.
Rusty.
The Last Men have made it their mission to eliminate hybrids. But we've made it ours to protect them.
Now, there's talk of a virus, and there's that seems certainly familiar to us. And what's interesting is if you go back and look at some of the stuff that this movie deals with, it seems familiar because it was made during the pandemic. In fact, they shot this during the pandemic. They got special permission to shoot in New Zealand. And as the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic was going on, they could react to it. Now, I don't know how similar this is to the original source material, but I can tell they certainly drew from what was going on in the world. There's even a scene in there where they kind of flash back to the beginning of it where this guy's flaunting hazmat rules and he's vaping and the guy's saying, well, that's just dangerous. And, you know, they have this little spat between whether, you know, what's safe and what's not. And of course that has permeated the culture and the discussion over the last several months, you know, longer even. So there is a certain awareness this has of what's going on. But of course, I mean, it's different. It's about a virus that is lethal and wipes people out on a much higher percentage, not to minimize COVID infections, because those are bad too. But, you know, it's a different virus. So, you know, it's not just a version of coronavirus, but it deals with a lot of stuff that has been the demons that has been haunting the world for the past 14 months. And, you know, so that's kind of interesting to have in there, but it does tell a story. And one of the things I like about it in particular is it's not just like a young adult story. It's not a bunch of ragtag kids fighting against the adults. You know, when I talked about Panic last week, and I'm just getting so tired of the cliches that keep circling the drain on that. And when you have a series like Panic, which is nothing but cliches, it's nice to see a series like this that goes down to different paths. So it's not just about a group of kids. The whole thing is that these hybrid babies start showing up. People start having not fully human kids, and they're like either part deer or part goat or part pig or part eagle or something like that. And they don't know how to handle them. And there's a connection between the kids and the virus and whether or not the kids have the rights of a human and some of the experiments that are done and some of the horrible things that are done in the name of saving people from the virus. It really does make you question how some people behave, you know, not just in general, but over the last year. So it has a certain social relevance to it, but it also is just an interesting story about this kid trying to survive, you know, after losing everything he had and not realizing that he's a second-class citizen and maybe not even a citizen at all. So it's effectively done, and it's got a great setup. The biggest complaint I have, because they drop all 8 episodes, I believe, this week on Netflix. So my biggest complaint about this is there's less of an overall arc, and it's more of a show of discovery for the characters involved. So I wouldn't say there's necessarily a dramatic arc where you're aiming for one thing, because even when you get, you know, through the whole series, you know, they keep things open so they can have additional seasons of this. I'm talking as vaguely as I can, but in doing so, you run the risk of not concluding stories. You just kind of have them keep going, and you kind of fall into that trap of being in perpetual setting up and perpetual world building. And they do fall into that trap in this series. I mean, if I were to say, what's this about? Well, it's about this hybrid kid trying to find his mother, but it's going to take a long time to get there. It's sort of like saying Lost was about people trying to escape an island. Well, you know, that doesn't happen until like season 6 on Lost. So it does not wrap things up satisfactorily, but that sort of plays into its strength because then it can have another season. So I'm still going to say Sweet Tooth kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The piece I want to talk about today is something that actually dropped last week on Amazon, and it's the supplementals for the Borat subsequent movie film. Now, let's play a little trailer here about it. Amazon delivers extra footage and behind-the-scenes content from the latest Borat movie, which hit the streaming service last year.
Yak shama, shama nam Borat. Wawa wawa.
This is called Alexa.
This tiny woman make a flirt on me.
Alexa, who trap you in this tower?
Nobody want to do sex on me.
Why would they when you have dirty hair and you smell?
In America, women are equal to men.
They have a brain like we have a brain.
What?
These liberal snowflakes have crazy ideas about women.
One of the things that I loved about DVDs when they first came on the market was the ability to have those special features. And for many years, that was the strength of having DVDs. That certainly, aside from just the sound quality and picture quality, that's one of the reasons to go for DVDs over VHS. And then, of course, when you have any sort of like box set, something that has multiple movies in it, or it's a definitive set, like I've got the extended version box set of The Lord of the Rings on Blu-ray, there's probably as much special features as there is movie. And there's a lot of movie in The Lord of the Rings. One of the downsides of streaming that's happened with all the convenience it gives us is we are losing these special features. But of course, the way the streaming services are now set up, they can build out and actually have special features to them. And what's one of the things I noticed, if you were to buy something on like Vudu, or even like iTunes, you can usually have access to some special feature content. And that's one of the things they're having with this Borat subsequent movie film. They made a big deal about it because it was such a big movie and it didn't come out fully in theaters. They have a 25-minute behind-the-scenes element, which is basically what they've done for the other Borat movie or the Bruno movie, where they've got extended footage, where they've got some extra scenes, which I think is really neat. I like the extended scenes. Normally, deleted scenes in a movie kind of bore me because there's a reason they're taken out. But for a movie like Borat, which is this sort of open-ended, get whatever you can, and then we're going to put together a movie later, you have some really funny stuff. And so they have elements in there that maybe hampered the flow of the film, but that are still very, very funny. So you get extra bits with Borat. So you get about 25 minutes of cool stuff. The other thing you get is a special, and it's called Borat's American Lockdown and Debunking Borat. Now, this has 7 episodes, which focus on Borat when he was living with the two guys during quarantine. These episodes are each like less than 10 minutes long, and they bring in experts to have a little Zoom call with the two guys who he lived with to debunk some of their theories. You know, elements like the control that George Soros has over the media, or whether or not Bill Gates was providing bricks for protesters over the summer of 2020, or whether they were putting microchips in vaccines, that sort of thing. Some of the most ludicrous, kind of over-the-top conspiracy theories, they address them. And this stuff's worth watching for no other reason than to at least get some expert discussion on some of these crazy ideas that people have. It doesn't quite work as well because the two guys are sitting there and you have these people of authority telling them, well, this is not the way it works. And they're like, no, I'd expect you to say that. I'm going to believe my crazy YouTube videos. Like, even there's one point, and they have it in the trailer for this, and they have this in the teaser for it. They bring in a video that Hillary Clinton made to these guys to debunk some of the conspiracy theories around her. But I don't think it had any effect on them because the guys just, they hate Hillary Clinton so much. They're not going to listen to her. She's not going to be like, oh, of course I don't drink blood and I'm not a cannibal. They're like, well, a cannibal who drank children's blood would absolutely say that, you know, that sort of idea. So some of these do fall flat, but it's interesting. And I think worthwhile, especially in today's environment, to go through and watch these. So at the very least, you get an idea of what's not actually happening with microchips and bricks and Bill Gates and George Soros. So I enjoyed it. I didn't think it was as good as some of the supplementals, and it wasn't as rich and completely full as some of the other supplementals of the Sacha Baron Cohen movies, but it's still worth checking out. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available on this week, we've got Boogie and The Courier as new releases, plus vintage releases of Tomb Raider, 2-movie collection in 4K, French Kiss, In-N-Out, Rat Race, The Stepford Wives from 2004, But I'm a Cheerleader, which is perfect for Pride Month, Backdraft in 4K, and Smokey and the Bandit in 4K, as well as Doctor Who, the John Pertwee Complete Season 2. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about In the Heights, the amusement park, and Loki. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.